Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast. I'm your host Vidushin Hantharaja and I'm joined today by Senior Football Correspondent of The Independent, Melissa Reddy, Northern Football Correspondent, Mark Critchley, and for his first run out of the new season, Assistant Sports Editor, Jack Rathbone is here as well. Hello to all three of you. Liverpool winning, Manchester United are not, and Kepa is making the same old mistakes again. That can only mean one thing. The new Premier League season is well and truly underway. As of last night, with Manchester City's first run out of the 2020-21 campaign, in which they beat Wolves 3-1, every team has now played at least one game. So what better time to assess where they are all at? We're going to start with the headline game of the weekend slash Monday's play. Chelsea versus Liverpool. Jurgen Klopp's side running out 2-0 winners at Stamford Bridge on Sunday. Melissa, you are on hand to cover this game for the Indy. What did you make of it? How did the Premier League champions or the defending Premier League champions look to you?
I think they were incredibly assured in possession and out of it. Chelsea were not in tune at all offensively. And I know we'll talk about the red card situation and Kepa's mistake, but before that point, they'd only managed one shot in total, and that was from outside the box. They hadn't had any corners. So I think initially it was quite a stifling job on their part, trying to contain Liverpool, who weren't really carving out clear opportunities, but were pretty comfortable, I thought, in the game. And it felt like it was a matter of time before they did exert enough pressure and get the opener. And then, as we know, Christensen fouls Sadio Mane. A great ball forward from Jordan Henderson. And with all the talk of Thiago, it was good to remember that the midfielders Liverpool already had, were excellent. Maybe not of the same pedigree or same technical abilities, but got them to back-to-back Champions League finals, 1-1, and got the league done and dusted. But that red card for me was born out of the fact that the defender had no trust in his goalkeeper, and we saw why later on in the game, as we've seen so many times before. Kepa is at a stage, I think, where it's not just about the technicalities of goalkeeping anymore and the basics of goalkeeping. It is massively psychological. He expects that he's going to make a mistake. His teammates and his manager feel the same. Of course, they're getting Mendy in. He's currently having his medical to join Chelsea. And I wasn't surprised at all by Liverpool penalizing Chelsea for their mistakes, because I think they were confident that those mistakes would come with the goalkeeper and just with the amount of changes that Frank Lampard does make.
Jack, you also watched this game. What takeaways do you think, I suppose Chelsea fans can have? They looked okay, actually, I thought, for the first half before Christensen's red card. I suppose you're also going to talk about Kepa as well. I suppose we'll start generally with the first bit of that question, in terms of what did you make of it from a Blues point of view?
Yeah, I think it was a conservative start from Chelsea, but I think with good reason. Last season, Liverpool obviously had the better of Chelsea, as they did with pretty much everybody. But there was method to what Lampard was doing, I believe, in terms of the game at Stamford Bridge last season and also at Anfield in the league games. Chelsea definitely came on towards the end of those games. And I think there was just an element of, with a reduced hand, given injuries and new signings not quite settled in, I think he was looking to sort of keep it tight and then edge into the game and maybe look to pick some holes in Liverpool towards the midpoint and the end of the second half. But clearly the red card had an impact and stifled that plan and or essentially wrecked it. But obviously, given the reduced options in key areas, there was a lack of pace given, Pulisic's injury, Ziyech, not so much pace, but the ability and accuracy to put balls in behind, and also Hudson-Odoi not quite up to speed or in sync with what Lampard wants to do. There was definitely an over reliance on Werner, who had a pretty good battle, I think, with Fabinho. I think a lot was made of like whether he could be a weakness for Liverpool at centre back. I wasn't too concerned for him. I think he did pretty well, and although Werner had the better of him on a few occasions, he more than held his own, and it was just very difficult for Chelsea to get out. And I think that all stems from the lack of balance in that midfield. There's really not a box to box influence. Kante can sometimes get there. Kovacic likes to dribble, but just a lot of isolated front men for Chelsea. And while they after a nervy first 5-10 minutes, they definitely settled and they sort of closed off the little pockets of space quite nicely. And Christensen, I did think, actually was one of the better players for Chelsea right up until that red card. He was defending that near post pretty well, came to the rescue when Kepa was a little bit hesitant coming out from goal, and closed off the space before Firmino could hit it into an empty net. So there was definitely something to be encouraged by had they survived that red card and sort of eased into the second half. But ultimately, it just proved obviously far too much in the second half to survive with 10 men, and Liverpool were always going to exert their pressure.
To talk about Kepa, as someone that you mentioned just there, in terms of having to be bailed out by Christensen, perhaps not as dominant coming off his line for that red card that means that Christensen thinks he's got a rugby tackle, Mane. He obviously gave the ball away for the second goal. And I feel like the mistake for the second goal is more understandable given that's a natural consequence of playing out from the back. You're going to be closed down, especially by someone of Mane's speed. But what do you make, where are you, I suppose, with this Kepa situation, Jack?
Yeah, I think the writing is certainly on the wall. I think Lampard's already spoken of the medicals happening as we speak, and bar any issues with quarantine, he's actually available for the West Brom game at the weekend. You'll see Caballero play against Barnsley, but yeah, I think it's certainly a case of he'll come right out of the team now, and I think it'll be tricky for Chelsea to shift him. So there might be an element of give him some time out of the limelight, and eventually he'll get through a bit of luck, perhaps with injuries. He might even come back into a team at some point this season. But it's just his uncertainty, and it's infectious in the team, and it spreads right across that back line. And the inability to command his area, while not an ultimate strength of Liverpool's, it certainly weakens Chelsea against teams that they might expect to beat, because it is such a clear vulnerability to the team.
Critch, we all know that Lampard spent a lot of money, and beyond that first half, perhaps I'm being disingenuous here by saying they laboured to that victory over Brighton in the opening weekend. We do know it was always going to take time for everyone to fit in, but what have you made of how, I suppose, stale might not even be the right word, actually, but I'll have to use it here, of how stale things have been so far?
They have been stale, yeah. And I feel like the worrying thing for Lampard is that almost the precedent has been set, if you know what I mean. So you've had one season where you brought in all this young English talent. It's performed relatively well, above expectations, some might say. Adapted well. That kind of inexperience hasn't shown. And then you've replaced it with them with a lot of, the finest young players in Europe, basically spent a lot of money on that. And like I say, I think the worrying thing for Lampard is that if we get to a situation at Christmas time where they aren't quite living up to the expectations, that the lofty expectations that were had in pre-season, then what if that logic suddenly extends to the boardroom and suddenly they realise, ah, well, the one place we didn't upgrade actually was in the dugout. It's kind of like when you refurnish a living room and you realise, oh, the fireplace doesn't fit anymore, or the big centrepiece in the room. You know, like this is it's kind of like they've taken a step in this direction, having kind of built themselves up, or at least the media certainly built Lampard and Chelsea up last season as this home of homegrown young talent and, you know, developing players, very worthy and, you know, righteous causes and things like that. And now they're in this kind of awkward situation as well, just to come back to the squad, where you have Werner, you have Havertz, you have Ziyech, so he's not fit yet. And you have to integrate these players into a lineup and yet also still try and stay faithful to this image where you were promoting players like Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. In one way, you can look at that and you can say, this is very good squad building and recruitment, because what you've done is essentially you have built and developed a lot of younger players who are relatively loyal to the club, most of them at least, and you've developed them into, you know, first team Premier League players, and then you've supplemented them and maybe superseded some of them with, like I said before, the finest young talents in Europe. But keeping that dynamic and that balance and keeping everyone happy is going to be a big challenge for Lampard, especially a manager of his relative inexperience. And to be honest, so far, I think the biggest takeaway that you can have from Chelsea's first couple of games is that he just hasn't really been playing the best players in their best positions. Havertz has looked pretty lost when he was played out on the right-hand side against Brighton. He was deployed as a bit more of a false nine on Sunday, when really his best position is number 10. And, you know, that may be a consequence of just trying to keep everyone happy and trying to work through the squad. But, you know, this is the thing about this stage of the season. We're only two games in. If we come out with big strident opinions on this podcast now, we're all made to look like fools soon enough. But I think at the minute there's a bit of scepticism about just how Chelsea have started and how Lampard's going to make the most of this squad.
I think we discussed this when we were building up to the start of the season, actually, that it's never easy bringing in so many new faces. And it's not just any new faces, it's the premier talent, young talent across Europe. So all these players, like Timo Werner mentioned, are coming to Chelsea because they want to start, they want to advance their careers, they want to test themselves in the Premier League. And there were quite a few things that became apparent to me. One, obviously, helping everyone adjust and settle in as quick as possible, with games coming so thick and fast in the most intense season we've ever known, was never going to be easy. But moreover, we don't really know what the hierarchy in the squad is anymore, you know. And while it should be, you know, about the collective and there shouldn't be any main man or main men, so to say, every squad does have some of the dynamics where, you know, you get the leaders and the new players that come in that have that status. That's one about, like, Virgil van Dijk did at Liverpool and Bruno Fernandes did at Manchester United. I didn't really, or I couldn't work out how it was all fitting in at Chelsea. But these processes take a lot of time. And that's why I think when people were discussing Chelsea as title challengers, it seemed quite far-fetched, because there's so much they have to do at the same time.
Well, speaking of, I suppose, challenging for the title, Liverpool... Well, it's worth talking about them. Everyone was going wild for Thiago after a very short first 45 minutes in red. I suppose for a player like him, he couldn't have picked a better 45 minutes to play, really. Opposition down to 10 men and tuning up pretty quickly as well. It looked for a long time that Liverpool wouldn't buy anyone. And then suddenly, not only do they have Thiago, but they also complete the deal for Diogo Jota as well. For an initial $41 million from Wolves. Mel, do you want to explain how both deals came about? Because, Am I right in thinking that certainly Liverpool aren't exactly a cash-rich team right now, but they've done these deals in, I suppose, in very roundabout and very smart ways?
Yeah. To start off with Thiago, I saw a very funny tweet that he's playing the game at such a chess level that he even conceded a penalty so Alisson could save it and get his form back, because from the restart, the goalkeeper has been actually one of Liverpool's main concerns, which I had done a piece after the opening weekend suggesting that, you know, Virgil van Dijk and Alisson weren't performing at their optimum, but Liverpool aren't particularly worried about that because that will restore. But that tweet about Thiago was very funny. In terms of the transfers, I think the way the deals are structured are very important to note. With Thiago, £20 million for a player of his calibre is just startling. Another £5 million based on, you know, whether Liverpool go on to reach success in the Champions League and Premier League, with him being integral to that, that's also, they wouldn't mind paying that because it means they've won domestically and on the continent what they've set out to do. In terms of Diego Jota, I think the really, really instructive aspect of that deal is that Wolves, for the first year, were prepared to take 10% of the total fee. So that's the first payment. And they were also in talks with Watford for Saar. And Watford did not want to deal in structured payments or weren't as flexible as Wolves in how they wanted payment to be dealt out. I think the important thing to note with both those transfers is that people probably weren't expecting Liverpool to do business just because they were being quite measured. But it was always a case of trying to do what they needed or wanted to do in the best way possible. And obviously, especially with transfers, there's so much impatience around. But I think Liverpool have shown, again, in terms of recruitment, that they really understand what benefits them, what suits them, and how they can get the best deals over the line, but with the players for the positions they really want.
Is this a kind of change of tack then from FSG? And is it representative of, I suppose, Jurgen Klopp's increasing influence that he's able to, I suppose, you know, on his own, not necessarily on his own accord, but I suppose through sheer will, kind of, you know, ask for these deals to be done and then they get done?
I don't actually think it's a change in stance. Obviously, the Thiago deal is different to a signing Liverpool would usually make because of his age, his injury history, the fact that they always think long term. So, you know, the planning for the next 5 years and such. And the core of the squad is they need to make that younger or, you know, foresee a way where they're already planning for when, you know, the front three and the midfielders are all beyond their peak. So in that regard, it didn't really fit with their usual policy, but this is a world-class midfielder. And it always reminds me of when Sir Alex Ferguson, when Van Persie became available, he said, you just have to do it. And I think that was the case in this regard. In terms of Klopp and FSG and that dynamic, Klopp and Mike Gordon, the FSG president who runs the club on a day-to-day basis, and Michael Edwards, the sporting director, are all very close. And actually, it's often Mike Gordon and Michael Edwards, in terms of incomings, who are letting Jurgen Klopp or telling Jurgen Klopp, we have to get this done. It doesn't matter how much it costs. Which was the case with Van Dijk. Klopp was like, oh, you know, all that money. And they were like, we have to get it done. With Thiago, he wanted to wait until he trimmed the squad first. And they were like, no, we have to get this deal over the line. So I think there is a little bit of a misunderstanding about their relationship and how it works. And there are still people that believe Klopp is not getting what he wants, but he very much is. And that relationship is very strong.
Grand, right. Well, that's all we have time for in part one. Part two will be with you on the other side of this break.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome back to part two of the Indie Football Podcast. And having discussed Chelsea-Liverpool before the break, we're on to other matters such as Manchester United 1, Crystal Palace 3. Now, Liverpool's win on the bridge was obviously the standout result, but this feels like the most pronounced and certainly one that is worth poring over, especially with old boy Wilfried Zaha doing the bulk of the damage with a brace. Critch, you watched a lot of this kind of Manchester United performance over the last few years. Was this more of the same? Are the problems new and deeper than they first appear? Or are we just losing ourselves a bit in the fact that this was just one game? They haven't had a proper pre-season. Various issues relating to injury and fitness and positive tests and quarantining and this, that and the other. Tell us how we need to feel, Critch.
It is worth going through the mitigating circumstances, I would say. So you have some of the ones that you mentioned there, which are that they basically haven't had a pre-season. The Europa League campaign finished 35 days before this fixture, I think. They had about 10 days worth of actual training time. They had one pre-season friendly. They lost it away to Aston Villa. And obviously within that time as well, aside from any kind of things going on at the training ground or football matters, you've had the club captain get arrested and convicted and appeal against his conviction in Mykonos. You've had Mason Greenwood's problems with England. You've had Paul Pogba testing positive for COVID-19 and then starting this game, which surprised me, to be fair. And I think he didn't look at his best, if we're honest. I don't know. There's Aaron Wan-Bissaka as well was quarantined because he travelled to Dubai when he actually kind of wasn't supposed to and has had to miss some training because of that. So there's a lot of problems falling on top of each other. And I think, as I've said elsewhere this week, like if there was just one of those, you could probably ignore it. The accumulation of them, I don't think you can. But at the very same time, it's exactly what you said before in terms of I tweeted after the game, yeah, am I just going to have to write the same article twice a week, every week for another season? Because it feels like this was exactly the sort of performance that we come to get a bit used to from United, certainly under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And in fairness, perhaps not over the last 6 months. I think since the arrival of Bruno Fernandes, they've had that. Inside the club, they always talk about X factor in terms of signings. And I don't think you can argue that Bruno Fernandes certainly has that X factor. And he's managed to, whether it's through his kind of risk taking, his ambitious passing, his sense of adventure, just a general kind of, you know, he doesn't play safe. And I think that has dug them out of holes against teams who like to defend in low blocks and sit deep in the past, like teams like Crystal Palace. But if he's not on it, and if Pogba's not on it, then you really do struggle to see where the creativity comes from. And you struggle really to see where Solskjaer's style of play is meant to, you know, what kind of, structures and systems that he's working on in order to create that as well, independent of his players. So I feel like, yeah, this is exactly the same sort of thing that we've seen before. In fact, if you think back to the defeat against Crystal Palace at the start of last season, this game was practically the same if you take out the contentious penalty. It was a situation where Palace go ahead, United struggle to get back in, eventually get a foothold in the game, and then while they go in search for another goal, they get hit on the counter-attack again. And, you know, it's a bit of an indictment, really, that despite the signings, despite all the talk about transfers as well, that within like a year, there's still not been any progression there and that they're still serving up these kinds of results. And so, yes, while there's a lot of mitigating circumstances in their favour, I mean, they're not the only team to start their season late. And off the top of my head, Aston Villa and Manchester City both won, and Manchester City last night looked pretty impressive while doing it. So, you know, it's not the excuse that perhaps people are using it to be. So, yeah, I feel like it's an interesting one to watch. The back end of last season, we saw that they got better at these sort of games. Maybe this is a bit of reversion to the mean. And, yeah, it's one to keep an eye on.
Before we go on to talk about the rest of United woes, it is worth saying that Crystal Palace were very good. Jack, I suppose, Wilfred Zaha, excellent again. Where do we think his future lies? Because it seems more and more that certainly as my understanding of it goes, that Palace want a certain amount of money for him, in part because United are taking a cut of whatever they get in terms of a fee, so that bumps it up. And while obviously they haven't been happy with the fee, with the bids they've got so far, there seems to be more and more understanding between Zaha and the club that there is a number that people have to hit, and if they're not going to hit that, Zaha's going to still be a Palace player, and he's still putting in performances like this as well. I think that's very rare for both parties, actually, for a club to back their player and a player to stick to their club despite having that mutual understanding that, you know, their future might lie elsewhere.
Yeah, undoubtedly. I think you've got to credit Zaha for bouncing back this season, because I think by his standards, he was relatively average last year, but mixed in with some bright spots, obviously, because he's very capable of individual brilliance. But just the way he has harnessed a frustrating situation for himself, which is kind of his own doing, given that the length of a contract, he's got 3 more years left. So if he really did want to leave, then perhaps he shouldn't have committed quite as much. But just so impressive in the way that he is harnessing that frustration on the pitch now. And he obviously has that explosive nature to his game, but the composure now and the way he has ice in his veins, as you can see with that second goal where he sort of calmly just dragged it back into the corner, is so impressive. And he just embodies everything good about Crystal Palace at the moment, in terms of allowing Roy Hodgson to have that dangerous threat on their counter-attack, and then just allow Hodgson to sort of put the pieces in place behind Zaha and the quick, pacey forwards in midfield and also at the back. And yeah, it looks like a really good setup there now. And Zaha, in terms of his future, I just see it at Crystal Palace. I don't believe that there is a club that values him as much as Crystal Palace do. And I think that is just symptomatic of perhaps a very unique era in the Premier League, where sides outside of the top six, when they do come across I think it's fair to say he's not quite world class, but he's getting there, and performances like that at Old Trafford certainly will elevate him to be in that category. When you do come across a player like that and you're not quite in that, certainly Champions League, Europa League status, then that player is worth infinitely more to you than it could possibly be for a side like Everton, who were linked with him. And I just think that Crystal Palace will hold tight, because as soon as you lose players like that, you heap the pressure on players like Townsend, players like Eze, who's just come in. And imagine the pressure on Eze had Zaha gone straight out the door. I mean, you could see Crystal Palace sort of spiring a little bit when all the focus would be on a player like that making the step up. Now he's just very happy to come on off the bench every other week, start a few games. And it's all because Zaha just shoulders so much of the burden, and I just think he's worth too much to Palace to let him go at this stage.
What about Roy Hodgson? A lot of people were tipping him as the first manager to be binned this season, but 2 wins from 2. Old dog learning new tricks?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think he's been fortunate in terms of the squad dynamic. We know we've spoken about Zaha and Eze, but yeah, Andre, Jordan Ayew is absolutely brilliant in terms of his work rate and the way that he he is able to complement the other players there. And also Andros Townsend, I think a bit of a masterstroke from Hodgson to bring in Eze, and you almost saw Townsend maybe edging towards the exit, but that seems to have sort of injected a little bit of motivation in him. And now they just have so many options. It's quite rare, really, when you look at sides outside the top six or seven to see such depth. And I think you look at maybe what they could do in the transfer window. They might get one more in, but they've added Batshuayi, who you assume eventually will come in and start games. But they've got so much depth. I mean, Kouyaté starting at the back just against United, but you think maybe they need someone there. But they've just been unlucky with injuries at the moment. You think Tomkins, Cahill, Dan, and obviously Sacco right there now. So they've got plenty of options. And you look at Mitchell at left back, perfectly adequate, steps in for Van Aanholt. It's a really nice underrated job he's done in terms of working without masses of money. And I think you have to credit Hodgson, because he is under pressure, not just from us neutrals. I think Crystal Palace fans certainly maybe getting slightly restless with the style of play, but in terms of like a lack of room to manoeuvre this squad, given the lack of riches like I just outlined, I think he's done brilliantly to make them such a versatile team.
Well, speaking of money, well, Mel, we'll move on to you. Not so much for the money side, but specifically to talk about Ed Woodward, who spent his entire summer chasing after Jadon Sancho, with Borussia Dortmund pretty resolute that the England international won't go for anything less than the asking price of 108 million. Only Donny van der Beek has arrived so far, and he scored the weekend when he was brought on for his debut. Deadline's less than 2 weeks away. Do you reckon United not getting Sancho would represent a major setback, or do you think it's worth them for these fortnight at least focusing on more pressing issues such as a centre-back or a left-back?
I think it would feel like quite a disappointment, primarily because of what a magnificent player he is, and is one of those who can fill in, you know, when Messi and Ronaldo are no longer at the top of the game, and you'd suspect the likes of Sancho and Mbappe to be jostling for the Ballon d'Or on a regular basis. So because of the player he is, the high ceiling he still has, the excitement, and United are predictable, he would help with that weakness of theirs. That's all negativity, but there are more pressing concerns. And I think we get caught up sometimes thinking that cosmetic changes will fix everything. I think United are one of the clubs that have proved previously, no matter how much you spend and who you bring in, if the structure and the philosophy and the vision and the people in charge of the decisions are not correct, then it doesn't matter who the names are on the pitch at times. And I think Critch raised some very important points there in terms of having to write so regularly the same sort of match report. And I think the issue with United is they're so geared for counterattack, and they're very geared as well for individual brilliance, which, you know, talk about transformative player Bruno Fernandes when he walked in January. The run that they were on owed so much to him coming in, taking the responsibility, being the main man, just switching it on and inspiring everyone around him. But that has a lifeline, that has a shelf life. And it's, I don't see a strategy without the ball in terms of just when teams sit back, when it's not individual brilliance that's breaking them down, I don't see what the strategy is. And I don't know how many signings will appease or make that better or rectify that, because for me, it's more, I think I want to see more in terms of the coaching side of things, the element, because transfers are not the answer. And I think, like I said, United have been one of the clubs that have proven that to be the case.
I feel like this might be one of the first times that you could, you know, if you flew a banner over Old Trafford with that slogan, transfers are not the answer. Probably be one of the more well acknowledged banners. From one side of Manchester to the other now, though, City, a distant second last season, started their delayed campaign with a win at Wolves on Monday night. With that man, Kevin De Bruyne, again proving he's pretty good with a goal and an assist. Critch, you were at Molineux. How did City look in their first outing?
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. I was, the first half was set better than the second half, certainly, you'd say. But then again, like almost like I referenced in the last answer about United, they have their own mitigating circumstances, if you like, there. You know, they haven't had a pre-season either. They've not played a single friendly, in fact, after the exit from the Champions League. It was just the day before United from the Europa League. And they've obviously had these problems the last few weeks with the players testing positive for COVID as well. It's three now. Aymeric Laporte, Riyad Mahrez 2 weeks ago, and then it flipped my mind, Ilkay Gundogan yesterday as well. So Laporte was missing from the match day squad yesterday. Mahrez on the bench. Gundogan's missing. And also Sergio Aguero's out for possibly a further 2 months with the same knee injury that he picked up during the restart. So when you think about it, they were missing the best defender. They were missing their most prolific striker. And they filled the bench with like three kids, basically, that they'd taken from the academy. And this is, you know, one of the wealthiest clubs in world football that we're talking about. But that didn't really seem to affect the performance as much. I was really quite impressed with just how quickly they settled down into the game. Guardiola was using a kind of 4-2-3-1 that he'd not used so often before, time and again, you know, every so often. But it was in play last night. And I thought what was particularly good about it, and wrote a piece afterwards, was that he had kind of double pivot, if you like, of two holding midfielders with Rodri, who struggled a bit last season in his debut year just to get to grips with English football and to adapt. But alongside him, Fernandinho, who'd obviously played in the centre of defence and was really, I think, a huge miss for them, just because he's so good at the kind of intelligence and the nous that it takes to play in that position. What he's also good at is the little tactical fouls, if you like, although Guardiola doesn't like to admit it, you know, that is something that Fernandinho excels at, and though Rodri didn't quite pick up to the same extent last year. So having those two alongside each other made them really solid through the middle, I thought, and that was particularly important because they're against Wolves, and Wolves are one of the only, they did the double over City last year. United were the other team to do that as well. And, you know, if you think about Wolves and United, you think about two kind of defensively compact, low block, but quick on the counter-attack teams. And that's exactly who City had struggled against last year. And that was largely what was responsible for a lot of those nine defeats that they suffered in the league, the most of Guardiola's managerial career. So, you know, I wrote in my report last night. Last night was the little bit. It's the first game of the season. You don't want to draw too many conclusions. But it did feel like a little bit of a litmus test, just a little bit of, you know, significant in terms of how they were going to approach these types of games this season, because they just couldn't handle them last year. And from that perspective, I thought, although they tailed off a little bit in the second half, and perhaps you can explain that because of all the circumstances and stuff that we've mentioned, I thought I was generally quite impressed with them. And I don't know. I picked them to win the league title at the start of the season, our pre-season pod 2 weeks ago. It's funny how, like, your perceptions and stuff change just for the matter of two games. And I was swaying towards Liverpool, particularly after the Thiago signing. But I don't know. I generally think it's going to be a very close race between the two, perhaps not to the same standard that we expected of the last 2 years. But yeah, I think City certainly showed up last night, and that's a warning to Liverpool and to the rest of the teams in the top flight.
In terms of this prospective title race, how important is Fernandinho going to be? Because obviously there was a period where he was tried out at centre-back, probably not entirely accurate because he was, you know, a justifiable option there, and did have good games there as well, and you could see the thinking from Guardiola. But, you know, where are City going to benefit the most from him, I suppose?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about Fernandinho is that he's 35 years old, and he's defied this, time, basically, since Guardiola's, like, second season when he the first title winning season where he was probably the best defensive midfielder in the league, and he probably was for the year after as well. And I think it's no coincidence that those were the years in which City won those titles, when he was the fulcrum of the side, if you like. He could initiate, all the press, if you like, went through him. He was the guy picking up those fouls, like I said, but also legitimate tackles as well and interceptions. You know, he was just picking everything up in the middle of the park. And I guess the only question is whether he can still do that. You know, we were asking that question 2 or 3 years ago. I think now it's a little bit more relevant because Guardiola said himself last night he did struggle for fitness a little bit last year. They do have other options in there now with Rodri. You know, the thing 2 seasons ago was that they were looking for this Fernandinho replacement and trying to get one in, and whether it was Frankie de Jong, whether it was Jorginho, or, you know, all these other alternatives, all those deals seemed to collapse at the last second, and it meant keeping Fernandinho there. So they were always looking to get this succession plan in place. But I think last year it proved it was a little bit too early for it. And so I imagine, I don't know, maybe 35 years old, maybe if he plays like 20 games or like 1,500 minutes, something like that, comes in for these specific jobs, like last night away at Molineux, against teams that City tend to be vulnerable against. If that ultimately makes the difference and means that they pick up points in places where they didn't pick them up last year, and they can maintain the same level of performance in the other games, then that's going to be a huge benefit for them. And so he is important in that way. I think the only concern would be his age and just whether he can fulfill all these minutes in what is already such a compact and such a difficult season.
Jack, just to talk about Wolves now, they were outplayed pretty comprehensively in that first half, but then looked more like themselves in the second. And you could maybe say that if they taken one or two chances, then we've got a completely different outcome. But I suppose you can say that about most games. But Nuno talked about the need for signings before the deadline after the game. They've always operated with this smaller squad. And, you know, now that they've lost Jota, you know, we can understand why he wants to reinforce, with Nelson Semedo actually being someone who could be a Wolves player by the time this goes out, actually. Do you see other areas where they need to strengthen? Let's say, you know, to offer some assistance to Raul Jimenez, who at times seems to be doing it all on his own?
Yeah, possibly. I think the loss of Jota is almost a perfect storm for Wolves to cash in on his, I suppose, his peak value since he joined the club. And I think the emergence of Podence is actually, well, in theory, it has the potential to make Jota's departure quite forgettable, I think, given how lively he's been over the end of last season. And actually, last night, I think after the first half, where City just one and two touch just sliced them to pieces, I mean, it was really effective and efficient game plan by Guardiola's side. But once they sort of settled into the game and sort of bridged the gap between midfield and the attack, and were able to sort of transition much, much quicker, they found so much space in behind. And they do have those players, like you said, Semedo's going to arrive, which is going to release, you would think, release Traore a little bit more. Podence, the way that he drifts into little pockets of space, he's so effective. And they obviously have the number 9 to finish it all off. So I think Semedo will be a really important signing for them. And I think at the back, you get a full season out of Willy Bolly. Cody's still pretty strong. I think Saïss looked to me like a real weak link in that first half, but he has been dependable for Nuno for a little while. I guess he'll show some loyalty towards him. But just really excited to see how Fabio Silva does. And there's a lot of potential there, and I doubt we'll see him scratching the ceiling of that potential this season. But just a really bold move from Wolves, and I think you want to see that from them. They want to start punching a little bit further up the table and maybe risking a bit more, because I think they have now the options with the way they operate in the transfer market to acquire these sort of high potential players. So I think last night was actually, even though in the end it was 3-1, as you've already outlined, there was real potential in that second half to be level or even ahead, and just super wasteful at times. But once they sort of settled and realised that City did have some vulnerabilities, notably down their left side. I think Ake, maybe a little bit of a teething issue in terms of the line him and Mendy were operating on, just not quite a cohesive unit, that City back line, which was understandable given the makeup with Stones and Walker as well. So yeah, not always lost, I don't think, for Wolves, given Jota's departure. But you're right, Semedo's arrival will be massive, and Nuno's job will be to make sure Silva can sort of emerge into the Podence role of last season, and Podence can sort of step up and operate in the Jota role. And I think, lastly on that, Podence certainly has a bit more versatility to be effective in a three or a two, whereas clearly Wolves' main issue last season was enabling Traore and Jota in the same system. And when they did move towards that three, it just didn't quite work from Jota's point of view. So yeah, from Nuno's perspective, I think he'll be excited by the challenge of getting a little bit more out of his squad.
Mel, from the signings alone and from what you've seen of Liverpool so far, do you think there's enough to close that vast gap between Liverpool and Manchester City? And I suppose from a City perspective, not just close it, but, you know, finish ahead of Liverpool by the end of the season?
I do not think anyone is expecting such a great gap at the top, regardless of which team is at the summit. Last season was pretty ridiculous. Liverpool weren't expecting to be in that position. I don't think City were expecting to tail off so much. And both teams have very different motivations heading into the season, but I think that would keep them and restore them to the campaign prior, where, you know, they just pushed each other so much. I can foresee that happening again. I think the greatest thing about City yesterday, you know, Mark was talking there about all the factors, the COVID cases that they've had, no real preseason, no friendlies, their ability to perform, and that first half in particular, where they were so dominant. And Wolves are an incredible side, especially at home. They're very, very tough to play against. And City made it look so effortless. The fact that they were able to deal with all the obstacles that they'd faced so well, I think is a good, very, very good sign, because perhaps in the past, that's been the one thing when everything's not going their way. You have seen the manager and then the players not react in the best way to those setbacks. But you can see that now for me. And I think when we built up to the season, we spoke about this. It's still Manchester City and Liverpool in a league of their own, competing with each other. And I think games between them will be the best in the league again, and the decisive bits of this league. The rest are just in a battle for top four and whatever else.
Fair dues, fair dues. Well, on that subject, Mel, I will just keep you on for this one. But who else impressed you this weekend? Or rather, or, you know, even conversely, didn't impress you? We'll take Manchester United as red.
Yeah, Manchester United, obviously, like we've spoken, just way too predictable. And I thought Palace could have done more damage against them. Arsenal, hugely impressive. In terms of the dynamic that they have going there, I've spoken about Mikel Arteta's influence on the pitch and off the pitch, and I think you can really see it coming to the fore. The chemistry between Lacazette and Aubameyang is extraordinary, and if I'm not mistaken, I think they've actually combined they're their second highest combination since 2018 for goals in the league. So keeping Aubameyang there was hugely critical for Arsenal. They managed to do that. Son and Harry Kane and the way they combined, that was brilliant, especially since Southampton completely outplayed Tottenham in the first half and yet somehow found themselves at the end of such a hammering. That was a really important result for Spurs. Was impressed by Brighton, who have quietly done very well away from home in the league, which is a very, very good sign, because, you know, I don't think they want to be struggling and having to worry about relegation, and form away from home, I think, helps in that regard. There's Everton as well.
You just name me everyone in the league.
Yeah. Everton have been fun, and fun is a really important thing. Oh, Leeds. Leeds have been so fun as well.
Critch, if there's anyone left, is anyone? What do you make of it? Is any maybe a player or a team that have impressed or disgraced themselves this weekend in your?
Well, when I knew you were coming to me, I started going through them. Then Mel slowly ticked them all off. I was going to say Brighton as well, actually. I know we've already just mentioned them, but I think you look through their 11, and it's just quite impressive. A group of, you know, their recruitment strategy for the last couple of years, seeking out kind of underappreciated young, often English talent, but not necessarily. They've put together a side that, kind of out of nowhere, because I didn't really have them doing much in my preseason predictions. Didn't have them going down, but not really challenging or anything, not overachieving. But you look at the side there, and it's talented. And, you know, they played against Chelsea, did well. We were unfortunate to lose that game, I thought. They've obviously got a great result at Newcastle as well, dominated the game from the first, like, 5 minutes, basically. And now they're up against Manchester United, so it can only get better, I suppose.
Jack, what about you? Who's been your surprise package so far?
Yeah, just... I was waiting for my pick to be named, but it's shockingly not been named. Aston Villa is a sort of a rare positive, I think, and three Premier League wins at home in a row for the first time since 2007. I think that's pretty remarkable, despite their period in the Championship. So I think Dean Smith, many people's picks to probably go down. So despite the influx of new signings, I think, you've got to give him credit there. I think they're building something at home. After the restart, even the games where they weren't winning at home, Chelsea at home, I think that was a fortunate win for Chelsea. So, yeah, looking really good. And individually, same team. Emi Martinez, a penalty save on his debut. Bold decision for him to go up there. I think he could have maybe gone abroad and played for a side at least in the Europa League. So, yeah, credit to them. Building a nice little fortress now at Villa Park to build another season in the Premier League.
Well, just before we say goodbye, much like Gareth Bale returning to Spurs, we welcome back an old classic in Hero and Villain. Critch, I've got you down for Villain here, which says a lot. But is there anyone in particular that you'd like to lay into after this weekend's play?
Okay, I haven't given as much thought to this. I'm gonna go with the second wave. That's the villain, because once that's, I know, I'm sorry to bring it all serious, but you know, the news today about the fans not being allowed back in the grounds from the 1st of October, I'm sure we'll speak about that over the coming weeks, but just the devastation that's going to wreak on English football below the Premier League, even at Championship level, even at Premier League level, to be honest. You know, you're talking about clubs, I think the Premier League estimates about 100 million will be lost each month that fans aren't in the stadium, and that's in the Premier League. It's going to devastate clubs much lower down than that, clubs like the team I support down in the National League. Yeah, sorry to be a downer, but that's. I think that we'll say that is the villain of the week. COVID-19, the villain of the year, you might even say.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, if that doesn't win every week, then we're kind of screwed, aren't we? If we've got to get our priorities straight. Jack, I feel a bit guilty throwing to you for a positive after this, but who's your hero of the week? Hopefully we'll say vaccine one day.
There's a bit of pressure on him, to be fair, but it's Son Heung-min against the world, it seems. So, four goals for him at the weekend. I mean, I'm a massive fan, but I would doubt whether he's got enough to come out against that villain. So, amazing clinical finishing. But, yeah, I think, sorry to be unable to lift the mood after that downer, but yeah.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks again to Mel, Mark and Jack for joining me, and thank you to you all for listening. If you are a new listener, please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a rating as well, because that is very useful for new listeners to find us. Make sure you're also following Indie Sport and Indie Football on the various social media accounts to keep up to date with everything that's going on, and we will see you next week. Goodbye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.